Hello, and welcome to the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. My guest today is Matthew Mullenweg. He is a developer, writer, and musician, born and raised in Houston, Texas. He's a founding developer of WordPress, the open source software used by over 31% of the web. That's very exact. You could say just a third, but I like the modesty.
We like to round up.
Yeah, okay. Hi, Matt.
Howdy.
You've just gotten back from Nashville and WordCamp, where you celebrated 15 years of WordPress. What was the show like, and how does it feel, 15 years?
Well, the passing of the years is just the passing of the years.
I mean, you were 19 when you started. When I met you, you were 19, and now you're 35.
Yeah, so it's been a little while.
I mean, there's a lot of change there, even if you hadn't started this company, right?
Yeah, but besides a patch of time, it was very exciting because we just released WordPress 5.0, which is probably the biggest change to WordPress in about a decade. And so that change came with the commiserate, like, excitement, fear, uncertainty, doubts, resistance, all of the above. And the release actually went out a few days before WordCamp US in Nashville, went on December 6th. And, there was, I think it was hard to tell how it was going to go because there was so much controversy around it. Mm-hmm. And it ended up going just fine. But literally the night before, I was like, well, maybe this is my last WordPress release. They'll kick me out after this. But
can they do that?
Well,
can they actually do that?
Sure. Open source. You can pick up and take your toys to the sandbox at any time.
You mean WordPress could move on without you?
Or people could move on without WordPress.
You know? Right, right.
There is a fork of WordPress, and there have been many forks in the past. I'm sure there will be many forks in the future that kind of take all the code and put different leadership in charge of it.
Sure, like WebKit or Chromium.
Sure.
How was the adoption? A little better, a little worse, about the same?
We ran some stats around that. So in 2016, we had a release also on December 6th, although it was a Wednesday instead of a Thursday. And we ended up doing, I think, couple hundred thousand more installs over a similar period of time for this one, but it's a little less than releases that happen at different points in the year. So December releases do get adopted a little slower, but I think now it's over 7 or 8 million sites.
It's a big change.
Picking up at a pretty big clip.
Okay, well that's good. It's a huge change.
Yeah.
Right in the past, like going from 4.x to 4.y, it wasn't nearly such a big deal. It was like, oh, this is the same but improved.
The last big change was probably version 3.7.
Is that, we worked on that.
So you worked on...
Or did we do 3.6?
I forget which one it was.
I think we did something and it was a big redesign and then there was a new version and it changed.
This was about 5 years after that.
Okay.
So wow. I'd say the one y'all worked on was the big change before that. And then a lot has been the same since like the early versions where we introduced plugins, themes, and the first WYSIWYG.
I mean, one issue is even if with minor changes, a lot of people get upset. And one of the issues when you're just dealing with open source is you don't have one client, you have a million. And you have very vocal opponents and very vocal supporters. And a lot of people, you don't know what they think because they're, you know, they're not the ones who talk.
Well, and the beauty of it, though, is you can give people choice and control. So that was the big thing that I think made our release smooth. It wasn't that, 5.0 and Gutenberg came out and it's 100% perfect. It's not. Like,
right.
There's already been a bug fix to it, and we're going to continue to make it a lot better. But we give people the choice. They can either choose not to upgrade or not. Or we created this plugin called Classic Editor that lets you upgrade to 5.0. and use the old editor. So you can get the latest and greatest under the hood improvements, but still have sort of the same editor that you've used for the past 10 years.
So that wouldn't be Gutenberg. You wouldn't be using blocks. You'd still be composing the same way.
Yeah, we call it classic versus the block editor.
Right. Okay. I know about the controversy about... So the interface... the content is accessible, always been accessible. The interface would be problematic for people with mobility issues, and there were key commands to work around that. But the issue was people thought there were too many key commands or was hard to memorize, I believe.
Yeah, there's some pretty nuanced issues there. We did a lot of work around creating keyboard commands to navigate everything Gutenberg. We did ARIA labels for screen label readers. We did testing with accessible technology users along the way. It can still be so much better, though. So I don't want to even say it's good.
No, I get that. I get you're not trying to sweep anything under the rug. It is a big challenge when it's something this visual, right? Because
so
this
that,
is,
I think, is fundamentally the thing.
Yeah,
is that this is we're comparing writing in a single box and the navigation and interactions with that to essentially a block or layout editor.
Right.
So something more akin to rearranging lots of things on a page. And that's probably two orders of magnitude more difficult from a conceptual point of view. And so that means if you're not able to see the blocks, that gets a lot trickier.
Sure.
And you might have less built into the browser or accessible technology to navigate that. So one of the things we're doing is also looking for other people who have done this, like created a really sort of AA plus accessible interface with something this complex.
I mean, it's like trying to make InDesign accessible, right? As opposed to making IA Writer accessible, yeah. Right?
Because
it's just one is a very, very, it's like making film editing accessible. It's very hard. And I think there are probably people who would say, well, you shouldn't make that at all. And there are other people who say, finally, you're making this. This is what I've needed because I'm an editorial designer and I need this flexibility. I mean, you're trying to appeal to lots of different groups. And this is much, much more complex than the old WordPress.
And ultimately, what made me feel okay about releasing, even though there's still lots of work to do, was that control thing I mentioned earlier. So I knew that on the day that 5.0 came out, it's highly unlikely, or there's only very educated circumstances where someone, no matter what technology or sort of mobility or vision, whatever they have, would be able to use WordPress 5.0 the day it came out, because they could use the classic plugin. They could stand old. They have so many options. So if you think of the accessibility of trying to use the block editor, I think there's a lot we can still do there. If you think of it as publishing a web page, WordPress is probably has the most ways to get content in and out of it than any CMS I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Early on, everyone thought of it as a blogging platform, which was great in the early days of blogging, but might have temporarily hurt some adoption in the, say, late first decade of the 2000s, right? Because because people were going to more complex CMSs that actually did a lot of the same stuff WordPress could do, but people didn't know WordPress could do that.
Hmm.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
For example, having multiple channels of content on a site seemed like something you'd need to go beyond WordPress to do, and it's really not.
And there's really, we're at a point now where almost any website you can imagine, certain web applications I wouldn't build on WordPress, but any website, you can do it with WordPress. And with blocks, we hope you can actually do it without code in the future.
So true WYSIWYG, and how is that going to write semantic markup? Don't you feel that you'll still kind of need to go in and clean it up? Or you won't? I won't answer my own question. That's why you're here.
I think we can make it even more semantic than before. And actually, some of the really cool blocks that have been created, for example, there's like semantic markup around recipes,
yeah,
or FAQs,
right?
Some schemas, and actually Google supports them and will display you differently and things like that. So doing that manually, you could in the past. And people had created some plugins for it, but they were kind of clunky. Mm-hmm. All the people doing Gutenberg blocks for this, it actually looks really good. And the other cool thing is when it's built using the block framework, kind of the SDK we made for Gutenberg, mm-hmm. it actually inherits all the ARIA labels and keyboard navigation.
Right.
So where previous developers might not have thought of that as much as Core does,
right.
Now they kind of get it, not for free, but they definitely get like 80 or 90% of the way there.
Right. It's like a pattern library. Right, it's
exactly.
Like it's a design system. Here's this pattern library, and here are these modules that are semantic and accessible. Because you get that for free. Did you feel?
What do you think? Because I think we're having a big struggle to turn around a little bit. Because you are also an expert in this field. because of the controversy when we were coming out, I worried that like WordPress's reputation among the kind of people who care about accessibility, which I count myself as one of, but like is marred in a way that is going to be hard to recover from. And I'm not sure what to do next there.
I don't know. I worry about that too, which is one reason during that controversy, I reached out to some of the folks on your design team and engineering teams, reached out to you. And eventually I just posted a thing announcing that Alista Bart was moving to WordPress, which to me was certainly not taking sides. And look, I've got folks on Alista Bart who are accessibility experts and very passionate about this. And I wasn't saying I don't care about their concerns, but what I was saying was I trust WordPress to get this right. And I know that we're going to be able to make this move very soon. So for what little it's worth anymore, I sort of put my little reputation on the line. It's like, okay, I like it. And you know, when I first posted it, like 2 weeks ago, there was a lot of positive, like a lot of WordPress fans were just like, yay. And then after about a week, I you know, you can repost your tweets, right? You can just retweet them like they were somebody else's and they go up to the top of your feed again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I did that. I did that, and I started getting really snide comments like, oh, I guess you don't care about accessibility. It was like, wow, within a week it had traveled from a sort of core group of folks who actually know what they're talking about and were struggling with the accessibility issue and didn't feel maybe that you were doing enough, to now it's just a meme. Now it's out there. Now everybody thinks that. I don't think it'll last, and especially as you continue to, you know, show good faith and... Are you doing an accessibility audit?
We are. There's two going on, actually.
Okay.
So, like, I appreciate that, and we will do our best to honor that. I mean, we really do care, and we'll try harder.
Okay. And that's not the point of our talk today, and I wasn't trying to ambush you on it, but I also...
No, not at all. I'm happy to talk about any of this, by the way.
Yeah, we had to talk about it. So, just before we... the reason I wanted to talk to you today and you wanted to talk was we had a dispute about browsers, actually. But before we get there,
it's 2003.
But I just want to go back to, I know. I just want to hear what Nashville felt like to you and what it feels like to have a product online for 15 years and have it grow like this.
Hmm.
I mean, have you done it? Did you do anything professional before WordPress is another way of putting it? Like, I failed at a bunch of stuff before I started doing web design. I had already failed at five other things. And I'd already worked in various capacities. I don't know. I mean, besides maybe a job at McDonald's in high school, I don't know. It seems like you might have gone...
anything for 15 years. That would have been tough.
But did you... weren't you able to turn WordPress into a business fairly quickly? So that, you know, early in your 20s, that's what you did?
Yeah. I mean, so I did a lot of freelancing.
Okay, cool.
Quite a bit, including like subcontracting for oil companies, working on Sarbanes-Oxley compliance software. I worked for CNET for about a year before starting Automattic.
Oh, wow.
That's what moved me out to San Francisco. You know, I discovered all this from leading a Palm Pilot user group. I think I told you this before, but... There was a Palm Pilot user group that I founded and led in Houston, and you would make some icons.
Right.
For Palm Pilots, and that's how I came across Zeldman.com.
Is that how we...
I'd seen on, yeah.
That would have been 1995, 1996.
Yeah. And then you started writing about web development and web standards and everything, and I came along that train.
We first met at South by Southwest Interactive, I think in 2001.
Yeah. Oh, no, it would have been a little bit after that, maybe 2002 or 2003, but right around then, yeah.
I think I was on a panel about web standards, and I asked you to come up. I said, oh, Matt Mullenweg's in the audience.
That was a few years later.
Okay. So we first just met. See, I don't...
Well, we met because I was talking to... Get back to browsers. Tantek Celik was working on Internet Explorer 5, which was at the time the best... most standards compliant browser, especially for new CSS stuff.
Yeah.
And I had been connected to him. He invited me to dinner And it was this big, long dinner at a long table at a Mexican place in Austin. Yep. And I sat, and there was like the three seats around me were empty. And I thought, like, do I smell funny? Why is no one sitting next to me? That thing. Right. And then I think you, Carrie, and Eric Meyer sat down.
With you.
Next to me. Yeah. And those three empty seats. And I was like, oh my goodness, like two of my idols have just sat down next to me. And I was kind of over the moon.
Wow. When you meet somebody, I have people I've known since they were quite young, and they're always going to be young to me, right? So if when I'm 90 and you're 75 or whatever, I'm still going to go, well, he's a baby, whatever it is. But yeah, there's something about the. I mean, I would say that you've certainly come up way, way, way. I mean, I think you were brilliant then, but you've really outdone yourself in terms of, you know, fulfilling your creativity and your ability to make something with code and with open source, with that community ethos. You've really managed to really make something wonderful, I think. So you should be proud of that.
I think the main thing I've learned is just that it's always a process, and it really is all about people.
How do you deal with, I mean, so this gets back in a little way to the issue we were talking about moments ago, but you know, anytime anybody changes anything on the web or anytime any software changes, people get angry, right? And Amazon adds one button, it still looks the same, and somebody gets annoyed because they can't find the thing that I knew where it was. Mm-hmm. You know, it's when you're an open source, you really have to present to the world. One thing I really loved when we did that design work for you back in the day was that you shielded us from that. Because going in, I thought, oh my gosh, we're going to have to present to like a million people. And there's going to be a lot of opinions. And you can't, you know, if you write down all the opinions, they cancel each other out. So what are we going to do? And you were a strong leader. And you just said, you know, just I'm the client, satisfy me. I mean, I don't think you put it that way, but that was what we had to do. And that worked pretty well. And are you still able to do that as big as WordPress is? Are you still able to sort of have some creative control and some vision, or is it super collaborative and you're just a voice in the room?
I don't know if either of those captures the nuance of of what it's like to develop for open source. Like I said, it is all about people. Feedback comes in all forms, and I try to really appreciate it, whether it's, you know, someone yelling on Twitter or a one-star review, or whether it's like a really thoughtful, you know, nuanced email, which I get as well. And I think the thing I learned from the process we went through with that redesign, the process was fine, but we only did one public iteration, meaning like we only shipped one thing. So if I could go back and do something again, I'd just say, okay, let's ship that, and then let's build into the project another 9 months after that, where we do three more iterations.
Boy, I hear that. That's how I want to work now. I really love client services work, but I think I was telling you this outside of this conversation. I want to be more embedded. I love the opportunity in-house people have to really work on something and reiterate it and fine tune it and test it on users. And a lot of times when you're an agency or studio, come from outside, you make a, you know, it's like, ta-da, magic, look how great we are, and then you go away. And then it's going to change inevitably, so why not be part of that change? And why not, people are going to react, and they're going to use it, and you'll discover all kinds of things, so why not be part of that? As much as I can, I try to now kind of catch hold of projects and stay involved as long as possible, as long as it makes sense to.
It's incredibly rewarding, too, because you get to see it grow up over the years.
Yes.
And new people join, and I learned so much from new people joining and contributing to WordPress, and especially the Gutenberg process. We had a lot of new folks using even new technologies, primarily JavaScript, not PHP, involved in that. So, yeah, I'm not smart enough for that to be my own vision. Like, it was really the concept of so many inputs. And then people leave as well, and that can also be a perfectly healthy thing.
Right.
As people work on other stuff. sometimes they return, which is also really exciting when someone's like been in a different world for a while and then can bring everything they learned over there back to core WordPress. You know, yeah. So they can take their knowledge of WordPress and their knowledge of everything else that they've worked on. So I see it as just part of a flow. And all I can be certain of is that at any point, it's imperfect, but it can hopefully get better than it was the day before if you're really open to feedback in whatever form it comes and you commit to that kind of process of sort of continuous iteration, Kaizen.
How do you relate, or do you relate? You live in San Francisco now, or the San Francisco area. How do you relate to the... But I don't think of you... How can I put this? I don't think of you the way I might think of, say, the founder of Twitter, right? Or the founder of Facebook. I think of you as having a different mindset than those folks.
Okay. I actually don't live in San Francisco. I live in Houston. So maybe that
helps. Oh, you're back in Houston?
Yeah, probably since maybe 2011, 2012.
How did I not know
exactly
that?
When, but
you had a place in New York, but you weren't there very much. I thought you sort of went between the two coasts. No, you're back in Nashville?
No, so Houston's my home base.
Houston, sorry.
I am part-time and say a little bit in San Francisco and New York, but I'm more like a visitor. So okay. I have a place there, but it's I don't make it as there as often as I like. I do think New York is the best city in the world, so you've got it right.
Thank you. We're having the worst weather in the world today, but thank you for that. If you hear like
there's no bad weather, only bad clothing, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm inside, so it's not too bad, but I try to think that I'm in the south of France, right, as I listened. But that's actually not waves breaking. That's cars honking and policemen with whistles outside. I live kind of on the edge of the island. So it's beautiful, but it means I'm also near a big entry point into a tunnel that goes to another borough. And so there's lots of traffic and lots of people speeding. They've got the hospital for old people and people who've had surgery. And then they have cars speeding through an intersection to get to New Jersey or I guess to get to Queens as fast as they can and running those people over. So it's an interesting place.
It's funny, as you said that, I could hear a little bit of the whistle in the background. It was almost like a sound effect.
That could have been my lungs, though, so I don't know. I don't know why I said that. You and I had a difference of opinion recently, occasioned by Microsoft's announcement that the Edge browser, that there won't be their own proprietary browser anymore, that they're going to basically just run an instance of Chromium. And all the business reasons for it made sense. But it saddened me and worried me because it means, to me, there's everything's Chrome. And there's a little Safari. I mean, actually, Safari's like 25%. Of phones and 15% of desktop, I think. And there's Firefox, and Firefox has some amazing tools especially for folks who are into advanced CSS. And it's very fast. But I remember, and I know you remember too, when, you know, you were talking about Tontic. After Tontic made IE5, Microsoft punished him by putting him on Web TV, and they delivered IE6 and basically said, we're done. We've made IE6. No better browser could exist. We've got all the standards, and we've implemented them as well as we want to, and for like 10 years, nothing happened.
Dark ages. Yeah.
I know that this will be different because Google likes to innovate. They're not going to sit on the thing, right? Like Microsoft was basically, we've won the web, we're done. Google's like, everything we do is on the web, so we're going to keep innovating. But I worry about one company having too much power, especially a company that's basically driven with advertising that watches us and knows where we're going and knows where we've been. And isn't Santa Claus. So you countered that by saying open source will save us. So I would like you to elaborate on
Yeah, I mean, I definitely bear many of the scars of that time as well. And it feels so quaint to to tell the kids about sites that said, you know, works best in Netscape Navigator or things. Mm-hmm. But you can also look at that as a problem for lack of standardization. So to get a little bit abstract, what are web standards?
Well, they're agreements made mm-hmm. reached by multiple manufacturers at a standards body like the W3C or ECMA. Right, but generally the W3C, it's where most of it happens, which we could talk about the W3C all day.
all day.
But that's what we have, but that's what we've got, and there's a lot of really good people working there, often for nothing, you know, basically doing that instead of watching television or spending time with their families, mm-hmm. flying at their own expense to meetings to argue about Arcana. But they're doing that, you know, so that we can have a more accessible web, a more adaptive web, right? The separation of content from its presentation was genius. We didn't know it at the time.
Mm-hmm. CSS is, I think, one of the best standards of all time.
Yeah, and even though initially it was primitive, and there are some aspects to it that can be frustrating, especially the older CSS. The genius of saying content is content, and we don't know yet what kind of devices or transactions we're going to want but let's separate these things. Let's separate behavior and how things look in different environments and the words. Those are three channels. That was genius, and it's counterintuitive. I mean, if you're a writer, you usually think, well, what does this look like in the book, right? What does this look like on the page? Mm-hmm. If you're a designer, you go, what's my text? And to be able to abstract like that, that was definitely a moment of great insight and great importance. So you asked, what are standards and why? Why do we need them? I would argue that if any one company decides what they are, that there are dangers, and even if it was the nicest company in the world that only did good things, there would be dangers. My daughter has at school they use Google Docs and Gmail and a bunch of other Google products to communicate and do their homework, and it's really cool. The stuff's all free, right? And they can even get a Chromebook for about $100. They can get a very powerful computer to do all their schoolwork. So they don't have to lug as many books around. And that's really great. But at the same time, there's a trade-off in privacy. My daughter's essay about To Kill a Mockingbird, that's going into artificial intelligence. That's being analyzed. That's data that someone is doing something with. And, you know, it can be worrisome. So that's my concern. If one group that
has a lot of good things, you covered, I think, a lot of the good arguments around it.
Okay, so what's the counter argument?
Well, I think it's good. Let's start with an abstract level. So
okay.
Standards are kind of like specs for software, mm-hmm. right? And inevitably, when those specs are implemented by different engines or different sort of code, they'll have different quirks and different behaviors. You know, most famously, to go to the CSS history, the incorrect box model implementation from Internet Explorer.
Yep.
Which sort of created a huge thing. I mean, when Microsoft did IE6, they had to have quirks mode that had like the old way of rendering things, and then they had like the newer way.
To not break the web.
I know. So this was an incorrect implementation of a CSS standard. So they took the specs and they built the software, and it was incorrect. Now, why I don't mind all browsers being built on a common engine is I believe that many of the things you're talking about, like user privacy, overly beholden to Google, etc., aren't impacted by the engine itself. It's more the client that's using the engine. So I imagine even after Microsoft builds Edge on the Chromium engine, I think it's called the Blink engine, actually. Mm-hmm. They'll still default to Bing for searching. Right?
Right.
And Brave, which actually just switched, which is sort of a cryptocurrency privacy-focused browser, which does a great job of blocking ads and blocking everything, that can use the Blink engine as well.
Great.
And now, as a web developer, I have a single engine that I can test and target against. But second, as an engine developer, instead of like 50 engineers at Microsoft making a poor copy, or just a good copy but with its own quirks because it's different code of implementing these BakeSys standards, they can now work on improving the same thing. So it's kind of like the idea that instead of us all making our own separate implementations of something, we can work together on the same one. We can find a common ground, almost like a treaty between competitors like Microsoft, Google, Brave, other people in the future, that this is something that we should all work together on. And then we'll have different user experiences, we'll have different implementations of privacy and cookie tracking and everything else on top of that. But this we can agree on. And I think that's actually really positive, to the point that I would actually love to see Mozilla abandon their proprietary engine and adopt and contribute to Blink as well. And then maybe WebKit do the same thing. There's no reason why we need all these different engines. And when open source, and two, everything's open source. So there's no, even if Google went super evil, other companies could still fork the software, much right. like Google forked WebKit back in the day, right. and do their own implementation of it. Essentially, you know, if my understanding of the chronology there is it started as KDE's, KHTML.
Correct.
And then Apple forked that to right. be WebKit because they had different interests. I think they kind of made up with the KHTML, but it was basically went in its own direction. And Apple, a famously non-collaborative company,
right.
eventually was not sort of taking into account Google and others' use of WebKit. And that's why Google created a new engine called Blink.
Oh, they definitely opened the door to that. I absolutely agree. Apple did. And I remember there was a brief period, I'm sure you remember this, where the lead engineer or a lead engineer on a product lead on Safari had a Surf and Safari blog. Do you remember this? Probably powered by WordPress.
Dave Hyatt.
Probably powered by WordPress, but it was this blog that just, you know, said, we're going to implement this CSS feature next. It was like, Apple doesn't tell you if they're going to use Glass in their next phone. That's proprietary. Maybe we won't. You don't know. Like, you're not allowed to ask questions. And it was completely out of character for them, and it was really wonderful. And then, gone. I mean, Dave Hyatt's still here, thank goodness, but that period of openness went away. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I can't speak to Apple's approach there. I think it's a little bit outdated and certainly doesn't mesh well with open source. By the way, I am not an apologist for Google. I disagree with much of what they do. Okay. But a lot of how they do open source does take into account the best practices. And I think it's maybe an artifact of it being a company where the engineers probably have the first seat at the table.
Right.
You know, engineers see the benefits of when open source goes right, when you share what you improve. If I maintain a fork, I also have to maintain all the improvements you make to it, which is a huge pain in the butt, actually.
Right.
And that's why they generally drift apart. If we can actually work off a common code base, that becomes a lot more like we're working on the same thing. And you can get natural
like monopolies.
Like a standard.
Right.
And it becomes both, you can still have the standards process for saying what's new or what's in the real standards, but you get, I think, a far more powerful consistency of actually anyone being able to use some essentially off-the-shelf example code to implement the standard. That's why the most successful standards generally include like some sample implementation.
Right.
It often becomes more powerful than the original document spec ever was.
Right, and conversely, when you write a spec, you're guessing, right? It's like agreement and then shipping code. Once you've shipped something, you actually see what it is, right?
Well,
Eric Meyer used to...
Our W3C episode could talk about standards that didn't take into account real-world usage.
Right.
I think some of the best standards, including what they did in CSS 2.1, mm-hmm. took the best of what was being implemented in the wild mm-hmm. and said, here's the common ground we can all agree on and work on together.
HTML5, that was their opening. They said, well, what are people really doing? Yes, it was a document language, but what are people actually building? And you know, we have a million people saying div class equal aside. There seems to be agreement that this kind of thing is conceptually called an aside. Why don't we make an element called an aside, right? Why don't we look at what people are actually doing? Why don't we pave the cow paths? Let's see what people are doing, right? Let's see what people are doing, and we'll make that. And we'll build it into the system, into the standard. And that was very much in contrast with XHTML2, which said everything's going to break and we don't care. It's going to be much more pure. It's going to... academic idea. Yeah.
It really actually goes back to earlier what we were talking about. I just assume that everything now is... and all that matters is how you know.
You're fading for... are you still near your mic?
All right, I stood up. Better now?
Yeah, you're still quiet, though. Okay. You know what we're going to do? I'm going to do a quick sponsor break and maybe unplug and replug in or something like that. Well, okay, here comes the sponsor break. Folks, today's episode of The Big Web Show with Matthew Mullerweg is sponsored by HoneyBook. Do you own a small business? Are you frustrated with dealing with back-and-forth emails, endless paperwork and hassles just trying to get paid? Honeybook.com can help you spend less time handling the administrative work and more time doing what you love. Honeybook is an all-in-one business management platform for creative small businesses. Honeybook makes it easy to streamline your process with client and calendar management tools and custom-branded brochures, proposals, and contracts. You can even get e-signatures, generate invoices, and get paid faster, all within a single online system. Over 75,000 photographers, designers, event professionals, and other solo entrepreneurs have saved hundreds, if not thousands, of hours a year with HoneyBook. And that's why we've partnered with HoneyBook.com to offer Big Web Show listeners 50% off the first year of HoneyBook with promo code BIGWEBSHOW, all one word. Big Web Show. So get started at honeybook.com today and use promo code BIGWEBSHOW for 50% off your first year. Again, that's honeybook.com, promo code BIGWEBSHOW. Thank you, HoneyBook. Thank you, listeners. And we're back with Matt Mullerweg. Born and raised in Houston, Texas, he writes code, prose, and music, and is a founding developer of WordPress. Peas popping.
By the way, I was just thinking, as someone who's been a fan of the personal and independent web for been published how long? Over 20 years.
Yeah. Since 1995.
Podcasts are definitely one of the coolest things going on. And I would say that, you know, the sponsors like you just had, it's awesome that there's an ecosystem. I would love to see more of this turn into blog posts.
Agreed. Well, one simple thing we could do is transcribe or just write about the conversation we had.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
We could both write about this, probably writing completely contradictory blog posts that prove that we heard different things, and both send people to the recording at 5x5, where they would decide if either of us had even a clue what we were actually talking about. Is everything fine in Houston? Did you go back for a family reason?
For Houston?
Yeah.
I actually read this essay on a great blog called, have you ever seen the blog Wait But Why?
I have not. I'm sorry.
It's a pretty good one. They write these super long essays. He did like a 60,000 word thing on Elon Musk.
Wow.
But he did this post called The Last Chapter. And he basically said how, if you think of like weeks of your lifetime or total weeks ever that you'll spend with your parents, you have 18 times 52, which is, you know, 936 weeks of your first 18 years that you spend probably with your parents.
Mm-hmm.
It's accepting like summer camp and things like that. Or total the rest of your life, you might spend just like two or three weeks a year with your parents, especially if you move away. But even if it's like 10 weeks a year, over the probably 30 or 40 years that they will live afterwards, that is probably just 5 or 10% of the total time you'll spend with them. So at the point when you're, I read this when I was probably like 28, 29, maybe 30. I was like, oh, the amount of time that I have with them is probably in this last bit. So I was like, well, let me try to make Houston more my home base. I'll fly from there, do my laundry there. And then whenever I'm in town, try to see my parents. And it ended up being something I was really glad I did, because a few years later, my father passed away kind of unexpectedly. And so knowing that there was those kind of last few years when I was in Houston a lot more was definitely worth it. And I have kind of the rest of my life to goof around and travel and everything. And I still do other stuff. But I'm glad I put in kind of the change of home base to get some of those extra weeks in.
That's very moving. My mom passed away in 2000. My dad is still very much alive, but he's 91. And wow. I've talked to him 3 times today, though, so that's something.
That's amazing.
I'll
send you a link to this post, and we can put it in the show notes or something afterwards.
That sounds great. I think that might be more valuable than anything else we've talked about to some folks listening. So I want to thank you for that. And now, wow, it's hard to transition.
Browsers.
Yeah, browsers, right? Browsers and devices.
Idea that, like, a common engine can be behind a lot of different user experiences, a lot of different browser clients. So you can still have choice, and we're not all like signing up on the Google train for the rest of our lives. But we get this common code that can be the basis. It can be essentially something that we build on for generations.
I'm of two minds. I think you made an extremely good case for it. As someone who used to do a lot of really frustrating QA back in the really bad old days, I definitely see the appeal. I think a lot of developers will see the appeal. I worry because I also remember that the monoculture was not good for innovation, but I get that this is a different one. I don't know. Then there's the sort of, the Mozilla people are really good people, right? And I don't want them, do you know what I'm saying? I don't want them.
They make most of their money from advertising too. Yeah, they sell that default search box thing.
Right. But then they all blog about how much they like DuckDuckGo. Right.
So they're, well, there's what you do and what you say.
So. Right. But they're not, I mean, the people I know there are like the real old time.
Oh, web, yes, yes. I won't say they're, yeah. I'm not trying to say they're bad people. So I should clarify that.
Okay. Yeah.
I do think that they haven't innovated. And I think the problem with Microsoft wasn't that Microsoft didn't want to be an innovative company and Google does. It's just about incentives. Microsoft's incentives at the time where it had the browser hegemony was essentially to kill it.
Right.
So it like gave it a bear hug.
Well,
Google is very much more dependent on the web. All of its primary applications, the business model depends on web innovation.
They're the ones
so
pushing
push things forward. Like
they're pushing PWAs. Exactly.
Damn.
They're the ones doing
AMP.
It.
Like some of these, AMP. I know these are now, controversial, AMP. But I like them.
PWA is great. AMP, no. Okay, point and counterpoint. PWA is great. Making an app, saying, you know, the difference between a website and an app, there is no difference. And here we go. And if you're in a tunnel and the thing goes out, you can still read the paper. You can still read your local paper, or you can still read Matt's last 3 posts on his blog, even though your connection went down.
Is it a web
standard, that's great.
Or is it just like a Chrome thing, right? Isn't it like everything you just
It is a web standard. Right. Service workers are a W3C web
service
standard.
Workers, yeah.
Right. So it's built with service workers, and then you comply with certain guidelines, and that makes it a PWA. It's a set of words. Like web standards was a set of words. Like responsive web design was a set of words. Basically, a brilliant guy, Ethan Marcotte, codified what he was doing with media queries to solve the problem of, I can't design all these pixel perfect layouts for all these new screens. It's like, yes, and we shouldn't, and we don't have to, and we'll do this instead, right? But it was a set of words that helped people go, oh, I see. PWA is a set of words. AMP, on the other hand, is Google going, yeah, HTML, we've got our own. And to me, you can give your counterpoint just a second. To me, AMP is Google going, yeah, we've got our own HTML, and, you know, use ours and put it on our server, and then you'll probably get some search results. And if you don't do that, you know, put it on yours. And their reasoning, their rationale is websites are too slow. You have too much junk on your website. But so, you know, on the one hand, if you're monetizing with advertising, you may be screwing your users five different ways and you're delivering this terribly slow experience and no one wants that. On the other hand, if you're sending all the traffic to Google and using Google's proprietary markup language, like, how is that a good, how is that, you know, for the benefit of the web? I think that's for the benefit of Google. So, yeah. Counterpoint, go for it.
Well, I do agree that it had a poor rollout. And particularly, I think one of the key mistakes early on was that the Google URL would actually show up in your browser.
Right.
But that just felt really yucky.
Right.
Now, the standard says Google doesn't have to host it. And you can have lots of other edge servers or different ways to do it. In fact, WordPress websites with the AMP standard do publish their own. So you can add /AMP to any WordPress.com site or anyone who runs the plugins. And you get a really nice, fast, performant version.
But why don't we instead go, HTML is a really good standard and I can make performant websites by knowing what I'm doing with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, I can make a very performant website. And by, you know, controlling my image size and being smart about SVG and being smart about web font, there's lots of ways I can make it. Like, instead of, oh, well, our special secret sauce makes it performant automatically. To me, that discourages developers from learning about the nuances of front-end development and encourages them to say, yeah, front-end is BS. There's no talent there. That's not real code, right? HTML isn't real code. Even JavaScript isn't really real code. Like, you know what I mean? But there is an attitude by a lot of engineers, right, that you know, a unique engineering solution to a problem that HTML or CSS already solved. So their unique solution wasn't needed, but it is new and shiny. I don't know. I'm also a curmudgeon, so.
Well, but AMP really is HTML. Like, it's more like a subset.
It is a subset, right?
And I think that's kind of nice because it's basically saying, "Hey, if we HTML, you know, the open standard is the most open thing ever, you know."
Right.
But that also makes it difficult to interpret. That's why it's so hard to build a browser engine now, for example.
Okay.
You know, that's why it's probably only going to be two of them in the world, if we fast forward 20 years.
Wow.
There'll be one that has like 85% market share, probably Blink or some successor to Blink, and then the other one that kind of sticks around because the natural monopolies in open source usually get to about 85 or 90% until like the natural forces kind of have other things be created or have like alternatives that probably hang out there. But I mean, that's why it's so complex. AMP as a subset of it, we can say this is a lot simpler and you can render the page in a predictable way and you can load the page in a predictable way. You can cache the page in a predictable way. And I don't mind that. Yes, it's different. It's actually really easy to generate. Like, the plugin that makes AMP is not hard. It's very complementary to Gutenberg blocks because you can just say, here's how the output, when you have a Gutenberg block in WordPress, here's a set of HTML that outputs to, say, email clients. Here's a set of HTML to put in the RSS feed. Here's something for your website. Here's something for AMP. That's why we have content management systems. Like, it makes it easy to generate out all of them. And it wasn't too bad, to be honest, to support AMP.
Is AMP easier to learn, you think?
I don't think it's any different. Like, it'd be hard to imagine someone who knew AMP and didn't also know HTML.
Okay. I've resisted even looking at it because I get so angry. I get angry at the idea.
No, but I would be amazed to meet someone who knew AMP and not HTML. Like,
right.
It's just kind of like a subset. It'd be like saying, like, I know 500 words in Spanish, but I don't speak Spanish. Like, it's fine. Those are the words. Those 500 can get you really far, and it's okay just to know those.
Here's another way of putting where I'm coming from. I hear everything you're saying. It makes a lot of sense. Okay. I don't disagree with anything you've said, but okay. So remember when the iPad came out and Apple had this like software and said, well, we're going to solve publishing. The publishing crisis, well, we're going to solve it. It's, you know, put your magazine on iPad.
They made that proprietary standard.
And I thought, no, that's not what's going to do it. Finding a better revenue model for publications. I don't know what it is. I wish I did. But finding a better revenue model or doing unobtrusive advertising like we used to do with the deck where we didn't spy and there was only one ad on the page. And, you know, and for a little while, we were able to charge a good premium because the page views, the views were actually worth something, mm-hmm. right? Like if you were reading Daring Fireball and you saw an ad, it was about something you'd be interested in anyway. It was sort of, it was, you know, a lot of effort. Yeah, they were great little ads. And, but so we haven't figured that out, and publishers are hemorrhaging money, and a lot of local newspapers don't, you know, all the stories. And so, mm-hmm. And so people put all their hope in, the iPad, and it couldn't possibly deliver. It's not that you can't put a magazine on the iPad and have a nice experience. You can, but it's not the solution that's going to keep publishing going another 20 years. And I feel like AMP is at least the way it was rolled out. It was sort of making a similar promise, like, here's, you know, actually, to me, you know, it wasn't even talking about money. To me, the promise was your content will get noticed. Otherwise, it might not. And I'm like, aren't you a search engine? Don't you have a control over that? It's like when Jeff Flake complains about President Trump and you're like, yeah, but aren't, don't you have something, some power? I don't know what it's called, some a checks or balance or something. You know, yes, I can complain. I'm just a schmuck, but you can actually do something. And
AMP equals Trump?
No, AMP equals, wow. Yeah, this is not going to work out. It made sense to me when I started it.
No. I where I thought you were going to take that was talking about the Apple News format or the Facebook Instant Articles format.
Yeah, I hate all those. I hate them all.
I think those are worth attacking. And AMP, we should cautiously support. So Instant Articles, and those are completely proprietary formats that look nothing. They're way further away from HTML than AMP is.
Oh, right.
And they're proprietary to those companies, where AMP is now open source, open standards, has an open governance model. They're trying to do it right by making it not just a Google thing. In fact, I think it is supported by Twitter and Bing as kind of other major players in the space, in addition to WordPress.
Okay. You are the open source expert, not I. I will give it some more consideration, although I don't think I'm going to change my long-term opinion, but you've given me food for thought, which is great. I can't believe it, but our hour is up.
That went fast.
It did go fast. I would love to talk to you again soon. I really want to thank you for giving us your time today on the Big Web Show and wish you all the best with everything you're doing.
And likewise.
Cool. Well, have a happy holiday, a safe out holiday. Are you traveling?
Nope. Staying in Houston, which is an incredible luxury.
There you go. Yes, I'm staying in New York as well. Very nice. All right. Peace. Be well, everybody.
Be well.